So the Sarawan method for understanding the game of chess has, I said before, it had two, there are two lessons that we can draw from his method and how it's related to this contraption of mind, the three-wheeled stair climber. The first is that the way that Yasser Sarawan approaches the game of chess structurally, I think, well, I'm going to use to offer a new definition of fascism, all right? And that the simplicity, the economy of terminology, this elucidation of the principles at work that govern the game in chess, I think, cannot be directly applied to the question of fascism, but offer some useful tools, a sort of useful perspective. Okay, that's the first. And, well, I'm going to offer a redefinition of fascism, and it's going to have certain features, how I'm doing that is by thinking of how Sarawan approaches the game of chess. Okay. Secondly, the notion of the indeterminate, incalculable, infinite range of value that the king occupies is the second major lesson. And I apply that in two ways. First is that the king in the game of chess for socialists should be the socialist project. That is the thing which we cannot give up. It is the thing that can only be denied, delayed. It is the fundamental thing of value that we fight for and defend. Okay? And to try and reduce that to a number or a set of numbers or to any calculation that employs iterative logic, to try and reduce it to anything other than our dream is foolhardy. Secondly, this indeterminate value of the king references, and this, you find this interesting, an effort that capitalism in general, this whole notion of private property and markets and wage labor, all of the things that capital is involved in, if capitalism does anything, it always ascribes value in ways that utilize, numbers, right? More so today in the 21st century than at any other time in history. And that I'm arguing, this very operation, which appears to be grounded in fact and unassailable logic, that when you ascribe value, when capitalism ascribes value to things, when it goes through this process of making something a commodity, it always represents itself as by using numbers as, an accurate representation of reality, when, in fact, that is not the case. Even in the game of chess, when you give a number to a piece and say and then argue that it has that value, it is only an approximation. It can only be an approximation. Why? Because the game is unsolvable. And this is the same in capitalism. Then when, a shoe is given a value of, let's use a fucking Nike for an example. A value of $350 because it has a LeBron James fucking signature on it or whatever, or flourish or whatever. There is, this notion that somehow that is right, that in the marketplace, supply and demand should reach an equilibrium, and the price of that shoe is right and just and correct a good thing, increasingly following the logic of Tina, that there is no alternative. The only way to achieve, to assert the value of a thing, right? When, in fact, this is not the case, that it is this very operation, okay, of assigning value, of using money as an exchange value, this is always, these are fun words, there are three of them, arbitrary, invidious, and injurious. Always, everywhere, and for fucking ever. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I'll get to that later, because I'm using very precise definitions when I use those three terms. And that this indeterminate, that the role of the king, both references the socialist project, our dream of a better and different world, and it also references, and this is really where I'm going with this, it references what I call the bit revolution. And the bit revolution is not the same as the information economy. It's not the same as the tech revolution. It's not the same as the computer revolution. It's not any of that, certainly not cognitive capital, as some fuckhead like Joe Biden referenced. It's none of that, all right? What the big revolution is the scaling up of this singular, ingenious insight. And it's hijacking by capitalism, all right, the logic of the bit, this binary logic, the hijacking of it, right, for profit, for inequality. I think that part of this dynamic is captured in a quote by the science fiction author William Gibson. He said, and this is quite a while ago, that the future is here, it just hasn't been redistributed yet. And I like to rework that quote as, the future is here, semicolon, it awaits redistribution. Pretty much the same thing. Anyway, this notion of the future being here, and it has arrived, it's key in any discussion of this bit revolution. And what I'm saying here is that the aspect of the future that has arrived is the obvious capability within our hands, at our fingertips, right outside our door, to totally eliminate want and need, to totally eliminate poverty, right? To do all of that. And that it's painfully obvious that that capacity is here. All right? And that this is really the central, one of the central contradictions of capitalism as it now exists in the 21st century. The first, which throughout history has been obvious, is the contradiction between private property, private markets, and democratic control. The contradiction between capitalism and democracy. Since the Great Recession and the scaling up of the bit revolution, the contradiction that's painfully obvious to really everyone, and that ruling elites, that those really sharp tools in that toolbox, the smartest among them, what they now have to contend with is the fact that all of that innovation, all of that rapid progress, all of that disruption clearly illuminates the hidden in plain sight truth that I just talked about. That it's not that something is in the way of this progress. It's not that religious strife or corruption or authoritarianism or totalitarianism or people just being stupid. Here are your category of analysis, right, is the people. Or that, you know, Brazilians are more corrupt than the French, or the French are lazy, or, you know, this is total fucking nonsense. And yet, it's repeated in different forms, some more sophisticated, right, than others. But they're always coming back. They always have to come back to defending why it is that all of this, in this world of plenty, that there is so much just soul-crushing want and need. And how you answer that question goes a long way towards what kind of anti-fascism you think is effective. Goes a long way towards what your definition of fascism would be. And it has something to do with what you think a desirable and viable socialist project might look like. So let's get right to a redefinition of fascism, shall we? So my redefinition, my new definition, if you will, it will use as its first feature something hidden in plain sight. I'm very fond of that phrase and everything that it references. So the first thing hidden in plain sight about fascism is that it has a political geography. In other words, it's located in a place, right? And it's not in a neighborhood. And it's not in a country, but it has a political geography. Over the 100-year history of the political phenomenon known as fascism, going back to the Italian fascists who popularized the concept first, we can see that its main sources of power, the schools of thought that have arisen to popularize its vision of a future, its understanding of the past, so on and so forth, that its main political, military, social, cultural, and economic life, if you will, it has been rooted in a political geography. So by political geography, what do I mean by that? Well, by geography, I mean, right, the landscapes, the, you know, mountains, you know, seas, and, you know, physical stuff, you know, of a place or places. And by what do I mean when it's political? Well, when it's political, it has, borders that demarcate nation states from one another, right? And that when you put those two things together, clearly fascism is a product of Europe and North America, period, full stop, right? It doesn't mean that all expressions of fascism have to be located in those places, okay? It doesn't mean that, much less, that fascism attaches itself to, how shall we put this, a gene, a white gene. It doesn't attach itself to Caucasians. It doesn't attach itself to a race. And all of those are totally fucking ridiculous concepts, by the way, that I don't traffic in ever. And the only reason I'm using them here is merely to point out the absurdity of using them at all. Okay? So, but one can say that fascism didn't start from, much less have an enduring influence in, Africa, nor in Asia, nor in Latin America. No, not really. One could say, though, that it has its, one could and should say, that it has its origins in Europe, right? All right, so if that's the case, if it has a political geography, I think that, you know, what I'm arguing here is that if you're going to define fascism, you might as well start with where the fuck it has been most influential, overwhelmingly influential, where it actually fought for and took state power and exercised it over many years, right, in conjunction with other nation states who were its neighbors, okay? So that's the first definition, and it's a redefinition, and it's, look, what I'm arguing for here is a refocusing on a political geography as a feature of fascism. And that political geography, by the way, is white nationalism in the 21st century. If you can't understand that, it's probably because you're coming at this from a liberal or conservative or, I don't know, some other tradition that uses language like authoritarianism or totalitarianism or populism. And if you come at it from this angle, then it gets very confusing because Duterte in the Philippines is a fascist, right? That the soft coup against the PT in Brazil was a fascist coup. Or, you know, Bolsonaro, the, you know, far-right candidate is a fascist. And indeed, he is a fascist. But that doesn't mean that, for our purposes, a definition of fascism need include all of these other expressions of it. What I'm saying is that you need to focus there first. Okay. Secondly, it has, fascism has a social base. And by social base, well, I don't mean the old Marxist binary, okay? You'll see that I make a break with what I call the old Marxist binary. It's very useful in the early days of defining fascism. And in the early days of fascism, what I call classical fascism, that the binary was more pertinent and held up better. And by that I mean that early fascism in Italy and Germany clearly came about in the context of the end of World War I and the rise of Bolshevism, and it was clearly also within the context of very militant, very powerful, and insurgent workers' movements in Western Europe and in Russia, okay? And that was an important feature that fascism defined itself against, in opposition to. It doesn't, however, follow that fascism will express, the growth of fascism in the 21st century would express that same dynamic. In other words, the old Marxist binary, and you'll read this time and time again, insists that fascism only becomes a threat when the left becomes a threat. That fascism only comes about as an alternative to bourgeois rule, right, when the only other option on the table for ruling elites is a workers' revolution. This dynamic does not hold forth anymore. What I'm arguing, and will argue again and again, that the social base of fascism doesn't correspond to that anymore, that it's something different. So, and fascism has a political geography, it has a social base, it has an ideology. And the ideology is not, we really need to make a break from the laundry list in order to understand really the simplicity of the fascist view of history and the future. And quite simply, the ideology of fascism throughout history is white Christian nationalism. Period. Full stop. You don't really need anything else. There it is. Okay. But we're still missing a couple other things.
Right.
Fascism also has what I call a motor. And it's what I call the Mars motor, and I've written about this in one of my other contributions, Two Ghosts of Anti-Fascism Past. The motor, the Mars motor refers to this sociologist's description in the early 1970s in the United States of middle American radicals. I'm not going to go into this. If you don't get it, then fucking read something. So middle American radicals were identified by the sociologist Donald Warren as a sort of contradictory movement on the part of white people away from traditional sort of liberal institutions you know, sort of identification with elites and with American pluralistic democracy towards George Wallace-type racism, to anti-busing campaigns, anti-immigrant stuff, so on and so forth. So it's radicalized white is what the Mars was. But what I'm saying is that this is not particular, not unique to that time and place in America in the 1970s. Actually, it's a feature unique to fascism. And the Mars motor is this notion of being trapped between an elite above and unworthy and ungrateful masses, people of color, below. And that in order to call something fascist, that motor has to be engaged. It has to be moving. In other words, you actually have to be fighting some element of elites above, and not just in words, not just in play acting, not just for narrow electoral terms, not just for some political advantage. I mean, you fight above and below. And this helps us distinguish ourselves from these assholes also, doesn't it? Well, it should. Unless you're a patrician socialist and you think that there are these vast reservoirs of unworthy lumpen proletariat who can never be organized except by fascists, in which case, you know, what the fuck? This is why this redefinition is important, is that that strand of Marxist analysis, this thoroughly patrician notion, which is, you know, dismissive, denigrating, nasty towards poor people and non-workers of all sorts, really is a fundamental element at work in misunderstanding fascism and why so many socialists don't fucking get it. Now, so the Mars motor has to, in order for something to be fascist, the Mars motor has to be engaged. And I am aimlessly fascinated with this. I think you can find that motor in every fascist movement in its movement stage. Okay, in any social movement, any political movement that's outside of norms has, well, a movement stage when it's insurgent, right, and a regime phase when it's captured state power. And it's important to distinguish the two. And what I'm talking about is fascism as a social movement, not necessarily fascism as a regime. Why? Because what's most critical is that you not allow it to get to a regime phase. If it's in a regime phase, you're totally fucked. Okay. So there's four features, but there's a fifth feature, which is really important, I think. And that is the importance of periodizing all social and political phenomena, that if you define anything like fascism as a social and political phenomenon, you also have to be able to periodize it, to track it over time. Why? Because it exists in space and in time. It exists in history. And the best way that I can suggest to do this is by taking a page from Regis Debray's book, Socialism, A Life Cycle, and doing two things. First, it would be very useful for somebody to analyze fascism over its 100-year history along the same lines that Regis Debray treats socialism. And if you read that article, you'll see what I'm saying. And I don't believe anyone has attempted this. I think it would be useful to do. I think using the four elements that I've included thus far in my definition of fascism, that carrying out this operation using the sort of categories, doing an analysis the way he does it, is critical to this definition. Right? And then secondly, in doing that, we periodize fascism into three different eras: classical fascism, Cold War fascism, and what I call 21st century fascism. And if we take the four elements I've talked about, we can see that the political horizons, the kind of the character that fascism took in its classical phase peaked, right, at the end of World War II, that the Cold War placed new limits. It overdetermined the political horizons of fascism, right, in its political geography, in its ability to mobilize social bases, in its ability to put forward its ideology, in its ability to engage this motive. We can talk quite a bit about and should talk about fascism within the period of the Cold War. And this is a frightening and terrible lacuna, if you will, at the heart of most analyses of fascism. Most Marxist treatments go right to classical fascism and then apply a definition rooted in that place and time to all sorts of fascism since then. And this is a procedure, an operation that's thoroughly iterative. It's just an iteration that just keeps getting reiterated. And it doesn't apply the whole. What would the whole? Well, the whole would be, what the fuck is different? And there are many things different about the world we live in now compared to the world 100 years ago. Yes? All right, yeah. So, therefore, fascism has changed. But you'd be hard-pressed in a lot of treatments that, you know, lean very heavily on Trotsky, that lean very heavily on any number of other analysts. You'd be hard-pressed to see any sort of nuance or treatment or acceptance that maybe fascism has changed. So what is that new era? When did it begin? And this is critical. Clearly, the end of the Cold War, 1990 thereabouts, produced what people like Leonard Zetkin and other analysts predicted, which was an outbreak of what are the new terms we use? Ethno-nationalism. We use ethnic cleansing, outbreaks of xenophobia. Most of these terms are not useful, haven't been useful. What's important is that you treated fascism in this time period, at the end of the Cold War, as beginning to have a different sort of characteristics, but having some different characteristics. And what I'm saying is that from 1990 until about 2008, 2010, until the Great Recession, that is an interregnum. That was the time period that defined whether fascism was going to be able to gain new footholds, be able to take a step towards breaking out of its up until that point, constrained political horizons, whether it was going to be able to start to become a social movement. And, well, I think we have the answer to that question, don't we? Or at least we should. Some of us knew that this was happening. Some of us said it was happening. Some of us described it, yelled to the high heavens, and said it over and over again. And others said, no, it can't be fascism. Why? Because there's no insurgent workers' movement. Wait, what? Yes, just over and over and over. Pure iteration and reiteration of a path going nowhere. So, that interregnum what I call, that's the interregnum for fascism that has been resolved as of 2010. And what I'm saying is that capitalism as a global system, the related very closely to this notion of the nation-state system, globalization, all of this also, I think, entered a new phase, a new set of arrangements, broke new ground for sure, with this thing I call the bit revolution. And that began to scale rapidly in the wake of the Great Recession. The Great Recession, I think, is very closely related to this. And what I will do in a further essay called God and Uber is show you how there were parallel developments intertwined, but not the same, not causal of one another, parallel but intertwined movements in culture and ideology, in popular culture, in high culture and elsewhere, represented wonderfully in the blood and soil zombie soap opera called Game of Thrones, and also within Uber, which is an expression, of course, of the sort of tip of the spear of the gig economy, disruptive sort of approach to the world we live in. Yeah.